blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
We will not go down. That's from Michael Hart. Yeah, that song is extremely appropriate for the times today, for today's show. A year ago, when the Israeli army, with the blessings of the U.S. imperialists and every other major imperialist power in the world, was pillaging and raping Gaza, trying to bomb and shoot and kill the Palestinian people into non-existence, Michael Hart penned that song, recorded it, and got it out as broadly as he could. It's a very powerful song. It has a very powerful statement, and I always get choked up when I hear that. It's a very beautiful song. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate. I think what I'll do is I'll start introducing myself with fake names every now and then, just to see who's listening and who can catch me. We have a packed show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Richard Montoya of Culture Clash on the new play, Palestine, New Mexico. We're going to be talking with P.Z. Myers also. This is the second in his monthly column. One of the issues we're going to be talking about is the California Science Center has been sued by the American Freedom Alliance, which is sort of a loosely connected up with the Discovery Institute, at least in their thinking, if not practically and everything else. But before we get into that, we're going to go back to Gaza. We're going to go back to what we opened the show up with, and we're going to be talking with Revolution reporter Alan Goodman, who's fresh back from the Gaza Freedom March. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Why don't you tell people who may not be all that familiar, may have just been a little hazy about what the Gaza Freedom March is, especially given the fact that there was not a whole hell of a lot of coverage in the mainstream media here. Why don't you tell people what was the Gaza Freedom March, what was it trying to do, and why did you go?
Okay, well, over 1,300 people from around the world, mostly the U.S., Europe, and Japan, but also from other countries, on the one-year anniversary of Israel's massacre in Gaza, set out for Gaza, determined to march in Gaza on the Gaza-Israel border on December 31st, demanding an end to the blockade. I mean, you mentioned the horrors of the war. In the years since, Israel and Egypt, the only two countries from which anything can enter Gaza, aside from the sea, have imposed a total blockade on Gaza. They allow in what they say is a minimal caloric intake to keep the people of Gaza alive. And there's been no ability to rebuild from last year's massacre. Buildings throughout Gaza, I mean, nearly every building is damaged. While the Israelis were in Gaza, they shot out the water tanks on the tops of buildings. They obliterated, for example, the American International School in Gaza, which and none of this has been able to be rebuilt. Building supplies aren't allowed in. Israel really is running Gaza, as many people have commented, as the world's largest outdoor prison. So our mission was, you know, other groups, people may have followed in the news, a delegation associated with British Member of Parliament George Galloway, which were bringing supplies to Gaza. But the Gaza Freedom March was specifically a protest march of people around the world in Gaza to demand an end to the siege and the blockade. And we were not allowed into Gaza, but that's kind of part two of the story. So I think I've caught your listeners up on the basic story.
Well, let me ask you this, a couple questions. When you said it was going to be in Gaza, this was going to be a joint march with Palestinians in Gaza?
Both with Palestinians in Gaza and with Palestinians and others on the Israeli side of the border. So the march was to have been held on the Gaza-Israel border with contingents on both sides of the border. And yes, with participants from Gaza.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when you were describing the situation in Gaza today, it really jumped out at me. And I do pay attention to what's going on in the world, and in particular spots pay attention to it. But even the idea, it wasn't until I started following what was going on both on your blog and in other sources, what was going on with the Gaza Freedom March, and that I began to really deeply understand this point that you were making of the situation in Gaza today. I mean, the Israelis are actually, ironically, they're actually maintaining what it sounds like, and even sort of recreating in a larger, worse scale, the Warsaw Ghetto.
Yeah, well, I and others have made that analogy. In fact, after I toured the Holocaust Museum last year and protested outside it with a banner saying, you know, with a quote from Bob Avakian saying that after the Holocaust, the worst thing that has happened to Jewish people is the State of Israel, I just noted while touring the Holocaust Museum many direct parallels, including the, you know, the basically starvation-level caloric intake allowed, the fact that in the Warsaw Ghetto, nearly all the organizations that provided social services and entertainment, culture, recreation, were banned organizations, and that in both Gaza today and in the Warsaw Ghetto, survival depends on smuggling goods in and out, in the case of Gaza, through tunnels that connect to Egypt. And finally, I made the point that, and I made this point because I reach out to a lot of people, and I think maybe some of your listeners have had this experience where your people are somewhat informed about the situation in Gaza and will be trying to break through to the larger society, and then people say, but what about those Hamas rockets? And just as a short answer, it's not a complete answer, but just to provoke people to think, I say, well, when you hear about the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, do you say, what about the Jew who threw a bottle at the Nazis? I mean, is that, you know, your starting point in understanding the Warsaw Ghetto uprising? So anyway, yeah, that's the situation.
Yeah. One of the things when you're talking about that this Freedom March was actually going to be, it was intended to be a protest march. At the same time, you met people, as you said, people from all over the world. One person that a lot of our listeners are actually familiar with might be this woman, Hedy, who was an 85-year-old Holocaust survivor. The fact that she was there was one thing, but the fact that she was there so committed to something bigger than herself and bigger than, I mean, really, it seemed like a lot of the people that went there were motivated by some very important things, both in terms of not just protesting the blockade and what's going on in Gaza, but actually the idea of showing solidarity and breaking this out into the world so that what's been a very much a hidden story on some levels is exposed to the world.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for the, you know, people came to this with all kinds of different perspectives and views, and I interviewed a lot of them, and I was in meetings with people and detained in the street with people and heard their stories and motivations. But one common theme was there were a number of people who had participated in NGO activity or relief activity. For example, I spent some time with the Bahraini delegation, an emergency room doctor and a nurse, and they were the first people into Gaza right after the massacre, after the bombing stopped last year. And they and a lot of other people were telling me that, you know, if we did the NGO thing, we'll do it again. You know, we'll go back, we'll be volunteers, we'll do relief work, but it's time to start protesting. It's time to start, you know, engaging in mass political resistance to this blockade. And you go in and you volunteer in a hospital and you come out and tell your story to the world, and that's very important. But this was kind of another level.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Hedy Epstein, yes, she was, 85 years old and extremely energetic. She is a Holocaust survivor. And people like her make it very difficult for, you know, the global powers that be to portray this as a Jews versus Arabs or Jews versus Muslims thing.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I'm talking with Alan Goodman about the Gaza Freedom March. Alan's just back from the Gaza Freedom March, and we're talking about what happened there, the purpose of it wasn't what happened.
Sorry to cut in. Speaking of reminders, can I just mention my blog is Alan, A-L-A-N, xgoodman.blogspot.com. And, I expanded there on a lot of what we're talking about.
I do really highly recommend people go to that. It's a very, very interesting, very insightful blog on this. Now, Alan, one of the things, as you mentioned, when you got there, you arrived in Cairo, expecting to not stay in Cairo and to get out. You were expected to be into Gaza before the new year and able to take part in this march and have a few days even to explore Gaza and talk to people in Gaza. What happened?
Well, we were informed in advance that the border crossing was being closed due to a tense situation at the border. This tense situation at the border does exist. Some of your listeners may be aware of the incident that happened where there was apparently shooting between Egyptian military and some forces in Gaza. This is a tense border. The tension, of course, has been created by Egypt, Israel, and their global backers. And in particular, there's a very tense situation now because the illegal tunnels at the Egyptian border crossing town of Rafah are the lifeline that keeps the people of Gaza alive and provides some, you know, connection with the outside world. Egypt is moving to build sort of a Mexican border-style border fence. However, it will extend way down into the ground to block the border. So there is a tense situation at the border. However, all the participants in the Gaza Freedom March made it clear that we understood the risks and we were ready to take them. But Egypt closed the border and refused to let us leave. When our buses were scheduled to leave Cairo, we had our first kind of major encounter with the Egyptian police state, which some of your listeners may have followed. But at that morning and for the next week, it was basically a series of encounters with massive, massive mobilizations of the Egyptian police and military to suppress our protests. This culminated on December 31st when we held the Gaza Freedom March in the middle of downtown Cairo. Cairo is a city of something over 20 million people. It's by far the most populous city in the most populous country in the Arab world. So while we were bitterly disappointed and outraged not to have made it into Gaza, we were front page news in Cairo and throughout the Middle East for 5 or 6 days in a row. Everywhere we went in Cairo, we were recognized. It was a major event in Cairo. And as I was leaving the Middle East, you know, the different regional newspapers I was picking up showed protests in a number of different countries in the region, including protests by Egyptians. And Egypt is a very repressive police state where dissidents get disappeared and tortured routinely and where there's no such thing as a permitted protest. So it's very remarkable and inspiring that Egyptians were stepping forward and protesting as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened with the refusal to let you to cross the border from Egypt into Gaza, things didn't shut down. And it wasn't just a question of having to march on the 31st and whatnot. But from reading your blog, it seemed like people became exceedingly creative. The response to the repression in terms of not being able to get into Gaza was not to either turn around and go home or to just sit quietly in a hotel. But there was all kinds of very creative things that were done, which I think really helped. You know, I know it helped internationally in terms of getting the thing out, that people continued to fight, but also the impact that it may have had on the Egyptian people themselves.
Yeah, that is what happened. I mean, I should make it clear that after several days of protests, the Egyptian government offered a deal, which was to put 100 people on buses, not as the Gaza Freedom March, but as a humanitarian mission, and allow them to go into Gaza. And this was overwhelmingly rejected by the participants in the Gaza Freedom March. In fact, one woman I know and befriended on the march, her husband is in Gaza, and she hadn't seen him in 6 months. And part of her motivation for going on the Gaza Freedom March was to get in and see her husband. And she refused to get on the bus, which is very heavy, you know, without any guarantee that she'd ever see her husband again. Just to make a statement that this was not a humanitarian mission. We were not going to let the Egyptian government off the hook. So there were a number of different protests. Maybe the heaviest experience I had the entire time is one night I attended, and I sort of stumbled into it by accident, actually, but a very large protest meeting, about 700 Egyptians, at the Journalists Syndicate, which, as I understand it, is the Journalist Guild or something like that. And it was a protest meeting featuring lawyers and journalists bitterly denouncing the Mubarak regime for building this wall on the border, for, you know, collaborating in the suppression of the Palestinian people. And at a certain point, they, in this meeting, the MC acknowledged and extended a appreciation to the Gaza Freedom March. And here I am, and an American citizen protected by that passport to a certain extent. And these people don't have that. You know, these people know very well that bitterly denouncing the Egyptian regime routinely leads to disappearance and torture. And they were doing this, and they were acknowledging and appreciating us being there. So that was a very heavy moment.
We're drawing up to a close here, but I wanted to get a couple of other questions in. Why don't we talk a little bit about what I read in your blogspot about the reaction in that press conference, and even the fact that for the Egyptian people that this was actually may have been even a form of protest that could allow them to get around the kind of police state repression. But I wanted to know, in terms of broadly in there, it seemed like there was a lot of indications. But I know often Egyptian students over the years have been very supportive of the Palestinian cause and standing against the repression that the Israelis have brought down on the Palestinians. I remember once 20, 30 years ago where hundreds of thousands of students flew Palestinian flags in support of what was going on. This was around the time of Sabra and Shatila. And I'm kind of curious as to, again, still, the response of the Egyptian people to what you're doing. And then to wrap it up, what do you think is the most important thing accomplished by the Gaza Freedom March and where to from here?
That's it.
5 minutes, brother.
Okay. I don't want to be, first of all, I don't really have my finger on the pulse of Egyptian public opinion. There was very widespread support for the Gaza Freedom March and for the goals of breaking the siege on Gaza. At the same time, you know, we were able to have conversations with a lot of Egyptians on the street. It's not a lot of people speak English, but some people do. And some of the people in the delegation were bilingual. And the wall thing is, you know, life is complex. Gaza is controlled by Hamas. The tunnels are controlled by criminal gangs. And they're not a humanitarian organization. And the Egyptian government was, you know, engaged in a major, major propaganda offensive while we were there around the tunnels, that drugs and guns and terrorists were coming through the tunnels from Gaza into Egypt. And my perception was, you know, this was not without impact on Egyptian public opinion. The press conference that you and I were talking about, that I wrote about extensively on my blog, was forces within Egypt struggling with other Egyptians to understand that the root cause of this situation was the blockade of. It's like pointing to a prison and saying, well, contraband's being smuggled in and out. Well, why don't you break down the prison wall and then you won't have that problem? So very broadly, a lot of sympathy for the Palestinian people, a lot of outrage, even shame and furious anger at the government. And at the same time, it's like anywhere. Their public opinion is polarized, and it's not like the regime doesn't have some public opinion cards that they're playing.
So let me throw in another quick question. U.S. involvement in all this.
Well, one way that this got revealed to us was when the delegation went down to the U.S. embassy to demand that they intercede with Egypt and impress upon them to allow us to get into Gaza. And, you know, it was kind of a bizarre charade where the U.S. ambassador or whatever flunky they sent out to talk to people was saying that, oh, we can't tell the sovereign nation of Egypt what to do. And then at the very same time, the embassy staff was overtly out in the street directing the Egyptian police to detain people on Egyptian public property outside the embassy. So it was just an example of the sort of, oh, we can't tell Egypt what to do. The United States provides, I believe it's $3 billion or $2 billion a year in aid to Egypt. It's the third largest recipient of U.S. aid and a place where people have been renditioned. And it's, if there was ever a puppet regime, Egypt is one in terms of its relationship mm-hmm. with the U.S.
Now, I also read somewhere, did you hear anything about this, that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was actually helping or assisting in some form in the construction of this wall?
I have heard that, and it's something that I would want to investigate. Mm-hmm. It seems important to investigate.
Okay, so closing comment. Wrap it up, man.
Well, you were saying, you know, what did, I mean, I think it was very, and here I think I do speak for, you know, overwhelmingly for the participants, that it was very important that there was kind of a turning point when we turned down the offer of 100 people on a humanitarian mission on a bus, and instead marched through as far as we could before being, you know, detained en masse in the streets, the streets of Cairo, with the message of break the blockade and free Gaza. And that resounded extremely powerfully throughout the Middle East, and that's something that, you know, has to be spread.
All right, Alan, I want to thank you very much. Now, again, your blog, tell people the address of the blog.
It's A-L-A-N, alanxgoodman.blogspot.com, and go to revcom.us for my ongoing reporting.
That's what I was going to say. You'll find a lot of Alan's reporting on the Gaza Freedom March and other questions in Revolution Newspaper. Alan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Alan Goodman, a journalist at Revolution Newspaper, about his recent participation in the Gaza Freedom March. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with evolutionary biologist P.Z. Myers. All right, that's the monkey from Manu Chao. And I thought that'd be a little bit of fun to throw in here for the monthly visit. Hopefully it'll get a little bit more regularly monthly with P.Z. Myers, professor of biology at the University of Minnesota, and the author of the Pharyngula blog, which is one of the most popular science blogs in the world, and always a place to get a lot of stimulation, argumentation, and insight and humor. P.Z., welcome back to the show.
Hello, glad to be back.
Yeah. Let's jump into this. I think you've heard about this, the California Science Center in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
Yes. The American Freedom Alliance says that the center is censoring the debate around Darwin. I mean, they filed a lawsuit demanding that demanding a lot of compensatory damages and a ruling actually that would force the Science Center and other institutions like it to frankly cater to intelligent design. What do you have to say about that?
Where are they going to draw the line? I mean, because, you know, if you just say that any old person who can cobble up a video is going to be allowed to show things there, that's going to open the doors to a lot of garbage. I mean, letting in this one piece of garbage will just let the flow start. So I think it's a terrible, terrible idea to allow this to happen.
Well, when you say this one piece of garbage, why don't we, you know, for people who may not be familiar with it, the idea was they were going to show, what they said was they were going to show a short film that was a pro-Darwin film that was an IMAX film, and then they were going to show a pro-intelligent design documentary called Darwin's Dilemma. You just described that as a piece of garbage. Why?
Oh, I've seen some bits and pieces of it. I haven't seen the whole movie, but I've seen enough clips to get an idea of what it is. Basically, it's arguing about the Cambrian explosion and complexity and all these other things that simply are not an issue for science, that we don't find any conflict with evolution in any of those concepts. So it's kind of an empty movie to be showing. But it's also, you know, indicative of a very common tactic they've got. Sure, they want to show this other pro-evolution movie, but what they want to do is set up parody. They want to pretend that their nonsense is the equivalent of serious science. So having them side by side and using a venue like the California Science Center is part of their propaganda strategy to get some respect for their ideas.
To me, I found it very interesting in relation to the attempt over the years to force school systems in the U.S. to actually teach the controversy as a way of edging in intelligent design and, frankly, creationism. And it seems like this is very much related to that. You know, the idea that they've gone after the Smithsonian, they've gone after a Museum of Natural History in, what was it, Oklahoma or Kansas or someplace? I think Oklahoma. And they have this idea that somehow this idea of teaching the controversy is a legitimate way to go.
Well, and also that window dressing counts, that all they have to do is put on the old lab coat and stand in a science auditorium, and that makes their work science, which it doesn't. It's an incredibly common thing. Here in Minnesota, the creationists love to book the physics auditorium at the University of Minnesota, because then they can announce they're showing their stuff at the physics building, and it sounds so science-y.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. I mean, isn't that what really is at the heart of this whole teach the controversy thing?
Yeah, it's a... putting on some props and pretending to be doing science.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that they also raise some more sophisticated arguments sophisticated, maybe not in science circles, but sophisticated in broader circles. The idea that it's a theory. Why are you so afraid of challenging the theory?
Well, there's a couple things wrong there. One is a theory means something rather substantial in science, and they do not have a theory that competes in any way with evolutionary theory. To say that evolution is a theory is a good thing. It's saying it's a powerful idea. And nobody's afraid of a challenge to the theory. We're just getting kind of tired of the clown circus that they're putting on for us that really doesn't address any of the major issues. They're going to talk about the Cambrian explosion, for instance, which happened about half a billion years ago. It's spread out over maybe 20 million years of time. Calling it an explosion is a real misnomer because it's the slowest explosion ever in the history of the universe, apparently. But they don't have anything new. All they're going to say is, well, gee, all these body forms emerged in the fossil record at about this time. Therefore, what? They want to argue there was a sudden creation event, I presume. But there's no evidence for that, and there's plenty of evidence for precursors to those forms in the fossil record that show an even more gradual appearance of these organisms.
That is exactly what they end up saying, is that, look, they give the sense that there was this, like, Tuesday, you're walking, you know, whatever, you're crawling along or whatever you're doing back then, and or whatever it or whatever is doing back then, you're just, like, existing, and then all of a sudden, Wednesday, there's a million complicated, you know, just really insanely developed organisms. There were elephants and zebras walking down the street. There were streets. There were elephants and zebras walking around. So there was this explosion. So, and then they, and in that gap, don't they argue that thing of the gap there, that they said there's a massive gap there and between these, you know, what existed before and then suddenly the development of these very complex organisms and creatures and whatnot fully developed. And so therefore there must be a God or something that created it.
Or something, yes, but they're never very specific about that part.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true that, you know, we do have some very interesting specimens from the Precambrian, you know, before the Cambrian, that what you find is many trace fossils, so you find evidence of burrows of things. So what you imagine was going on there is that the world was populated with small, soft-bodied creatures like worms, which do not have bony parts, do not have shells. And so all you have left is the traces that they leave behind. Then there's a little later period, it's actually called the small shelly fauna, where you find these little fragmentary shells. And what that was is all these little soft-bodied creatures evolving little tiny bits and plates of armor that were scattered over their body. And when they decompose, they're just kind of sprinkled all over the place. And it's only in the Cambrian that you start getting the fully armored forms that we can recognize from their preservation of the fossil record. So that's one falsehood that they perpetrate, is the idea that it all happens suddenly, there's no precursors. The other, of course, is what you mentioned earlier, that they like to pretend that all the body forms were established in the Cambrian. And it's not exactly true. What happened is that we seem to have fixed all of the animal basic body plans at about that time, a half a billion years ago. But that doesn't mean quite what they think it means. When we say that creatures have the same body plan, we're referring to fundamental layout of the creature, you know, where the coordinates are set up, you know, where the limbs and so forth are going to go, but not the details. Mm-hmm. If you look in the Cambrian, for instance, the first chordate, the first creature with a body plan like ours is a creature called Pachea, and it looks more like a worm than a fish, but it's kind of a flat-bodied worm, segmented, it's got no head. You know, that was our ancestor at that time. And so it's a little misleading to say that all the work was done in the Cambrian, because we have progressed a little bit from Pachea.
Just a reminder that we're talking with evolutionary biologist P.Z. Myers. To me, it's very heavy what they're doing with this, because they actually continue to argue what we're talking about now, about that, well, there's a shadow of a doubt, this thing that you've spoken to already about the it's a theory, why worry about it? But they've cast this now in relation to, like you're saying, putting a science cover on it. And one of the things they have, I can't remember what it is, but it's a list they have of scientists who dispute Darwinism.
Yes, the Descent from Darwinism list.
Yes, speak about that a little bit. So, because they constantly harken back to that and raise it up as, look, these are scientists who are not afraid to stand up and say we disagree with Darwin or we have differences with Darwin. And they say, and that there would be a lot more scientists that would do that if there wasn't this atmosphere of massive repression, if you simply come out and question the dogma.
Well, what it is not questioning the dogma, it's questioning the evidence. And people look pretty silly when they purport to be qualified scientists and they say that the Earth is 6,000 years old or whatever, or that there's evidence for a designer, which we haven't found yet. But yeah, the Discovery Institute put together this list. They just shopped around and tried to find a bunch of people willing to sign this little petition that they had. Last I recall, it was somewhere around 600 signatories, but I think it's gone up a bit since then. The thing is, of course, it's really easy to find crackpots. We're in a country of 300 million people, and this is a list with no quality control. If you want to get on it, you can get on it. They want you to list your qualifications and so forth. When you actually look at the list and inspect it carefully, what you discover is that there's very few biologists on it. That instead, what you have is a lot of engineers, not to speak out against engineers, but they're not qualified to analyze the biological evidence. There's a surprising quantity of dentists, MDs, things like that, but very few people who actually have looked at the scientific evidence. So what they've done is they managed to put together a list of cranks and crackpots, unqualified people who will rant about evolution without knowing much about it. So it's not very impressive.
Well, as soon as you mentioned dentists, you had me.
Yeah. If you send out a national list in this country on anything, you can get a few hundred people agreeing with it. You can send out a list saying, the earth is flat, and you will find a few hundred people who will happily put their name on it and say, yes, that's true.
I didn't know what I was signing, okay? One of the things about this, again, this the way they're approaching this and this whole idea of freedom of speech and the guarantees of the Constitution and blah, 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 all of this stuff, teach the controversy. Don't be afraid of questioning the dogma. One of the things I was curious about, and you've written about this somewhat extensively, the idea that this seems to be their own kind of wedge thing, where they're driving a wedge into even having an impact on some people who broadly are supportive of evolution, who broadly are supportive of Darwin, who believe in evolution and Darwin, and believe in the facts uncovered thereof. But there's a tendency growing, I think, in some ways, to say, look, why not just let the controversy flourish? Why don't we just don't pay any attention to this? Don't cancel the thing, the speeches or whatever, because, really you're only going to shine a bigger light on it. And if you just leave it alone, it'll go away. There's a constant push to sort of bring together, to find common ground in some way with religion or with, superstition or anything like that. And as a way of just sort of, we don't want to go into the fire because we may not come out alive.
Yeah. There is a good principle at work here that we should be following, and that is that if you object to free speech, the answer is more free speech, not less of it. So, yeah, I kind of sympathize that we should be letting these people air their ideas. We should be freely going out and arguing with them. The thing is that's what's happening right now anyway. There is no censorship or oppression of creationist ideas in the United States of America in the 21st century. Go to the bookstore, and you will find Mike Behe, you will find this new Stephen Meyer book, you'll find a whole bunch of books on creationism and intelligent design. They're not being thrown out. They're actually fairly popular. They're selling fairly well. If you turn on the television, creationist ideas get full airing. We have presidential candidates who are getting out there and endorsing creationist ideas. So it's kind of silly to argue that you're being oppressed when you're freely allowed to speak everywhere. The objection here is that they're trying to steal the credibility of science. They have no authority or credibility of their own, so they want to pretend that they are endorsed by real scientists, that they're using real scientific venues, and that's the kind of phoniness we object to.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, and we're talking today with P.Z. Myers about the suit from the American Freedom Alliance, a creationist front, basically. They say they exist to promote Western values, and then you look at their Western values and the dangers to the world. They talk about the dangers to the world are the Islamic growth in Europe and environmentalism. That gives you a sense of how scientific these guys are. We're going to move into something. We only have a couple minutes left, but you had a contest we announced on your first column. And ironically, I was looking at this stuff from the Discovery Institute, and one of the things they do when they talk about why this whole suit they have going on is a very big deal and should be treated as such, they basically refer to this tactic that's being used by these so-called the science establishment is basically appalling, especially given the historical connection between Darwinism and the development of Nazism. Well, that was one of the questions you had in your contest, and why don't we talk about the winner and the answer by the winner to that question?
Should have warned me. I would have dug it up.
Oh, okay. Well, you can speak in general on it. I mean, it's really, to me, it was just so, wow, this is really,
He gave a very succinct answer, and I wish I could pick it up instantly here. But basically, it's a no-brainer. It's a really bogus argument that these people are making. There is no good linkage between Darwinism and Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
That Hitler was a good Catholic. He did not in any way endorse Darwin's ideas anywhere in any of his writings. He was more likely to promote God and country and traditional values. He sounded very right-wing. when you read what he actually wrote. So it's just a completely bogus argument that he's making there.
One of the things that the contest winner actually said, which I thought was very interesting, is that the Nazis actually placed textbooks on evolutionary biology on their list of seditious books to be burned.
Yes. You know,
which was, to me, that sort of captures a lot. Now, PZ, one thing. These guys have argued that this lawsuit is extremely important, and it's a very big deal. And I would imagine you would argue the same thing from a different position. What would you say to that?
Oh, well, it's a big deal if we lose, because then all of a sudden the floodgates are open, and there's no way that a science institution can offer any kind of quality control. Because that's what they're trying to do, is they're trying to get around the demand for rigor in what you present in a science context. So that's a concern. But otherwise, it's such a big joke to even think about this. Because you have made a movie does not give you the right to demand that it be shown, right? This is true of commercial movies, true of documentaries. If every documentary could insist that it be shown in a venue of its choice, documentaries would do much better business than they do now. So
wait a minute, take notes on that, okay? I have a lot of documentarians as friends, okay?
Oh, yeah, tell them all you got to do is sue, you know, the right. Lowe's chain or whatever, and tell them, you know, you've got to show my movie in all of your theaters all across the country.
Well, I'm sure this is a subject we will continue to explore in your monthly column, and particularly because I do think the importance of it is look, if you seed ground to religion, you know, if science seeds ground to religion, we are headed for a very dark age. And to me, that's just not tolerable, not acceptable.
Yes, and what they're looking for is not equality. They're looking for privilege.
Exactly.
They want a special position in our country. Mm-hmm.
All right, PZ, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And we'll have you back again next month, early in the month.
Very good.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
Bye now. I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with P.Z. Myers, evolutionary biologist, professor at the University of Minnesota, and the author of the world's most popular science blog, and it's called Pharyngula, okay? And you got to go out and look it up, look up how to sell it. Just spell it phonetically. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Richard Montoya from Culture Clash about his new play, Palestine, New Mexico. Welcome back. That was Soy Campesino from Ska Cubano and their album Ay Caramba, a really great CD. And this one, you know, check this out. This one is worth checking out for the cover alone. You're not going to find two cooler looking cats on any CD anywhere. I mean, I look at that cover and I want what those guys are wearing. And as an added bonus, the music's great. This is The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're about to talk to one of my favorite playwrights, actors, comedians, all-around person, Richard Montoya from Culture Clash. And we're going to talk about his new play, Palestine, New Mexico. And it was actually something I really looked forward to. You know, I remember talking to Richard when he was talking about writing it, and I was intrigued by the concept then. And when I went to see it, I really thoroughly enjoyed it and found it to be, it was one of those theatrical experiences where you walk in and you just leave with a giant complex ball to chew on for quite a while and to keep your neurons snapping for quite a while. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, and hello to the Michael Slate listeners. Forgive me, I thought this was the Pocho Power Hour.
All right, we'll talk later, buddy.
We know those guys don't get up till after 12 noon.
Anyway, why don't you tell people a little bit about this play, Palestine, New Mexico?
Well, you know, it is complicated, and it's based on, you know, fact and rumor and secrets and basically set on a Native American reservation in New Mexico and against the backdrop of the after effects of war, in this case the Afghanistan conflict, and a soldier that comes home from that conflict back to the res in a flag-draped coffin and of the questions that surround that and have to do with identity and land and homeland and why we're even fighting this war and tribal ancestry and ancient lands, you know, deserts over there and deserts over here. And it takes on quite a bit, all in 77 minutes in one act. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say it's interesting because all of the, you know, the stories that you just talked about, I mean, in a sense, I was fascinated by the way that those stories got developed, actually. And in a way, it wasn't like they were sort of, they weren't spokes on a wheel, but they were sort of like, they were more like waves that were sort of hooked into one another. And one story led to another, led back to the original story, led to another story. To me, a couple things hit me. One was the thematic stuff that was going on, the idea of this relationship between occupied peoples and occupied lands today all the way back. And I thought it was really, really very interesting the way you delved into that and how you presented it.
Well, you know, the play certainly endeavors to juxtapose and look at that and even the way that we're fighting this war, you know, of course, also why are we fighting this war, but how we're waging this war, and that we're fighting a very ancient people. And so we hope to be raising our big question mark on that and why we're doing that. Now, the fact is that Americans are there, and of those Americans there, you know, several thousand are young men and women of color. And that casualty list continues to grow as well. And so, you know, flag-draped coffins are making their way back to the barrio, back to the ghetto, back to the reservation. And I hope that for those people, like your listeners, would come and see that part of the story, which is handled in a stunning sequence where we use a lot of the video and visual images, where we are allowed to see and we take stock of many, many flag-draped coffins. The trick is how to make that into a, you know, a play that and a show that the wider audience will come in and see. There was a lot of worry about this play because, well, the war movies haven't been doing that well, although I would definitely suggest Hurt Locker and a couple of fine films that are out there right now. It seems like, especially at the holiday season when Costco and the Walmarts were just full of people, to get someone into a movie theater or an actual theater to see, hopefully, a thought-provoking piece with many, many themes in it. You know, this is the challenge, and I noticed that the kind of critical response was, you know, like a little slap on my hand for, you know, how dare we venture off the barrio, and how dare we have such, you know, wide-ranging tone shifts. You know, there's a couple different tones in this play. And I've been very encouraged by Russell Means, a political man himself, who said, you know, on the reservation, you know, we laugh a lot. You know, there is tragedy, and there also is comedy. And I'm also thinking of the Coen brothers, A Serious Man. I mean, they started off with the 16th century, you know, 15-minute piece, you know, that was drenched in myth and seriousness, and then a radical shift into, you know, 60s kind of satire. And I thought it was just swell, you know. And so I don't have those problems as a writer, but thank God for the blogosphere and shows like yours, because people really are finding the show and chewing on that big ball of rage and confusion.
Let me remind you that this is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with playwright and actor Richard Montoya, who is also one-third of the theater company Culture Clash. We're talking about Culture Clash's new play, Palestine, New Mexico, which Richard wrote and performs in. Well, one of the things that really gets me is that in terms of the response of the mainstream critics and whatnot, I mean, they act like going to the theater should actually be something that's rolled up nicely in a ball and presented to you, and bam, that's it. You know, and the idea that you've challenged people to think, because to me, even what you've been talking about, look, it's a sad statement on the state of affairs in terms of the lack of a movement of opposition, a significant movement of opposition in this country right now. All the stuff that people have been led to go along with, that when you present a play that, to me, operates on a lot of different levels. There's the commonality of people, and that's what I was kind of thinking about in terms of this, the theme of the, you know, all of these oppressed and occupied countries, right, and peoples. And the way you present the commonality, I mean, the whole idea of this soldier, and one of the things that he's accused of being a traitor for is because he refused to see the people in Afghanistan as dogs or animals. He treated them as humans and had respect for them in a sense that actually set him against everything that was being done there. The idea that kind of assessment of a call for peace and pointing out that oppressed people have more in common with each other than they do with the oppressors is what is considered like out of bounds these days.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that comment. I mean, like I said, Michael, you know, the blogosphere is alive and well. And I, you know, it's also sad that, you know, I wish more people were, but I mean, I'm not sure how many people are reading the LA Times, you know, the hard paper that you used to get on the street. And I think that has been kind of an issue with Culture Clash for years, and that who is reviewing us? You know, do they care about multiculturalism in Los Angeles and on the res? Do they care? Are they curious about the things? And man, I just, you know, I've read some really just kind of snide things that I just question the curiosity of what usually is a middle-aged white Anglo man reviewing a person of color's work. And that's, you know, that's not so much pulling the race card as it is sheer frustration that there's not someone reviewing our work with the proper yardstick, not a special yardstick, not a special measurement, but to take into consideration that, you know, Bunker Hill used to be tenements and that urban Indians have been thrown to the urban cities, you know, since the 60s. And what's going on the res? And why did a kid go to Afghanistan, find himself in a courtyard, try to bring ancient tribal peoples together, and it backfired on him? Why wasn't the U.S. Army doing this? Maybe the U.S. Army is doing this. Maybe special ops, but we don't know about it, and chances are, you know, something like that isn't happening. And how does that all reflect on the reservation? Where, you know, let's be honest, the reservation isn't a perfect place, nor should it be, but that there are secrets on the res also. There are secrets in the military. There are secrets in the sand here at home. And part of that secret has to do with a place called Palestine, New Mexico, and a Sephardic secret that has been alive and well in my own family in and around the hills around Albuquerque, New Mexico. And my curiosity and my restlessness to find out, you know, who the hell I am. You know, mm-hmm. I'd like to know why all my aunts from New Mexico look like Yentas and Fiddler on the Roof. I'd like to know, Michael. And the end of the play isn't saying, you know, turn to religion or, you know, light candles or, you know, in Judaism or Catholicism or Christianity. No, it's saying we do these things to fill a void, to fill a hole, and if spirituality is a part of it, then allow that in, but we're going to do all of that, and front and center will be a flag-draped coffin, and we're going to take stock.
Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slade, and you're listening to The Michael Slade Show, and we're talking today with Richard Montoya of Culture Clash about their new play, Palestine, New Mexico. Richard, one of the things when you talk about tone shifts, I really, that's one of the things I really liked. I think because of the complexity and the weight of the other stories that you're presenting, when you pull these things that just sort of it's something that you guys have really perfected, but in this play in particular, I thought it played, you know, not a minimalizing role, but actually allowed people to take a breath and consider the stories as they were unfolding in a way that was very, very cool. I mean, there's just a, you know, from your comments about, you know, you're being a Rhodes Scholar, and which I really wanted to find out how you get into that program, okay? But by the way, tell Herbert that he's really let himself go. I just couldn't.
That guy, you can't get him into a gym.
But you know,
I think that there's a generosity there with Culture Clash, you know, having been around 25 years and just celebrating our 25-year mark to allow ourselves to be bench and role players. You know, we've allowed Kobe and the guys to be out there and to really yield the stage primarily to three very dominant women that dominate the play and the voices of those women. And they're very strong in the piece. And we're at Culture Clash isn't on stage a lot. And there's something kind of wonderful about that, and in the collective spirit of the ensemble, and let someone else take it. And my God, we've got Russell Means out there, and we've got, you know, two of the young up and coming stars from, you know, God forbid, the Twilight series, and we've got an Anglo female army captain taking the lead, and Geraldine Kearns as Maria Quince, and this is, you know, part and parcel with you know, our old San Francisco days when, you know, you really, it was about the collective. That's certainly what the Mime Troupe was about in Teatro Campesino, and hopefully that, you know, that's alive and well in the piece too, and through that ensemble, it can be something, you know, quite powerful in the end. There's a couple different plays and there's a couple different tones, but I look at the rest of my day today, Michael, and there's a couple narratives flowing throughout my day. Part of it will be serious, part of it will be hysterical, and part of it will be trying to get ready to do a show at 8 o'clock, you know?
All right, Richard, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Comrade Slate, thank you.
No, 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 let's...
I'm in the mountains of Echo Park, people. Come and save me.
All right, Richard, see you again soon, I hope.
Thank you, Comrade Slate.
Take care, man. Well, that wraps up another show for another week. And as people who are regular listeners to this show know, I always like to point out about how much that we run into in the world these days really highlights the fact that the world is crying out for radical, revolutionary change. You know, and I sometimes think, as one person, a friend of mine once told me, that if you blindfolded yourself and you had a map of the world up on a wall and you just walked over and stuck a pin in that map, then when you looked at it, any place that the pin could have landed will give you countless examples of why we need a whole better world. You know, and this is the point here, and I was thinking about that especially in relation to Haiti today. As we wrap up this show, there's been the largest earthquake in 200 years in Haiti, and thousands of people are reported dead. Total devastation. This is one of the poorest countries in the world. It sits within spitting distance of the U.S. imperialist monster. And yet, you look at what's happening to the people in Haiti, and again, it's so clear, so very clear, that the world is crying out for radical change. That there is a better way that we could be and should be living. But to get there really depends on all of us. And that's what we're trying to explore and get to in the course of this show. To know the world so that we can change the world. Well, once again, I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. I want to thank my engineer for today, Melissa Figueroa. I want to thank my production assistants, Henry Carson and Age. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. You know, we're going to go out sort of coming back around to where we started this show, and that's talking about Palestine and the Palestinian people. We began the show talking about Gaza. And I want to end with a song from a brother named Gilad Asman. He's a musician, a jazz musician, who was part of the Israeli army in the aftermath of the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut in the 1980s. And when Gilad went into Lebanon to be sort of the part of the mopping up operation, he was horrified by what he found. And it changed his entire life. He ended up coming back and becoming a jazz musician. And he started writing songs that really called out the Zionist state and the oppression of the Palestinian people. So much so that Gilad decided he would go into exile. He now lives in London and has said he will not return to Israel until it is Palestine. Well, Gilad's work took a lot of songs that had meaning and resonance with Jewish people all over the world, and he twisted them a little bit. He did a new arrangement with them and sometimes put Arab themes and Arab musicians and Arab lyricists, singers, and to create some very beautiful work. This particular song that we're going out with is a song based on a song that resonates deeply with Jewish people around the world. It's a song that was about a pogrom in Eastern Europe. And Gilad took that song, twisted it a little bit, and renamed it Jenin after the massive refugee camp for Palestinian people in the West Bank. So until next week, Jenin.